Everybody, welcome to the Bulldog Hours on a Friday. Captain Joe alongside here until 4 o'clock, and we'll hand it over to our pals Nick Papagni, Nick Anderson, the Zone at that point. Also, high school basketball tonight with Nick Papagni coming up at 7. And for us, speaking of basketball, tomorrow both men's and women's teams playing Wyoming. Not the same Wyoming team. The Cowgirls are in, and the Bulldog men's team, of course, is in Laramie to play the Cowboys, and it'll be 1:45 with a 2 o'clock on 790 for the women. Jamie White's team playing great basketball, undefeated in conference. An hour later, you'll have the men tipping off in Laramie. That game is in the Mountain West Digital Network. But for us, 2:15 with Paul and Q, and that's Paul and Q, not Paul in Q, though. That's what will happen with the board op. He will have both Paul and Q in Q so he can hear what they're doing. 3 o'clock, they will tip it off, 2:15 tip-off show, and 2:30 the pre, and then the Bulldogs will literally, men's basketball team-wise, be on the road through Wednesday, because if you saw Kawada's piece in the B, you'll know that the team is not coming back in between. I would imagine that Paul and Q are coming back in between, but the team will be on the road all the way around the bend till the Wednesday game in Fort Collins, so a very long road trip. We'll talk more about that a little bit later on. CG and I will go over emails in the 3 o'clock hour, 2 o'clock hour. Marcus is always with us. Jackson's still under the weather. I know he's been dealing with a virus, and I hope he's feeling better, and we'll get back to Jackson next week. Also, one other thing. 49ers, of course, coming up. A lot of emails about that at tdad1@att.net. Those are ones I will direct mainly to Marcus. But we do not have the 49er broadcast anymore. When you get to the conference title game, we're embargoed by the national feeds, which belong somewhere else, not through ESPN. So all I can tell you is 3:40 our time on Fox Television Channel 26 on Sunday. 49ers and the Packers. We'll see how it plays out. To talk about that, everything else going on in the world of football, and the mighty USC Trojans, who have now laid waste to their entire athletic department, our good friend, the king of fantasy, the Culver City madman, the proud, I know he's an alum. Now, what, he's a proud alum right now, I don't know. It is the king of Trojan land. It is Sir Marcus Grant. Marcus, how you doing?
I have officially taken my name out of the running for any athletic department jobs there at USC right now.
You remember I mentioned to you when the Kentucky basketball job was open, our great friend Jack Furtick, who's still on air with us and with CG on a regular basis. I know he talks with Chris, right? I haven't talked to Jack a little bit of time lately, but we always catch up when we can. I told you that he had mentioned the one time to me, he said, I've told Andy Katz that I have taken my name out of consideration for the Kentucky basketball job. And I said, I didn't know you. He goes, I wasn't, but I wanted to make sure that Andy got it out there nationally, that Jack Furtick officially took his name out of consideration. So you're doing the same thing. If Mike Bone is looking for a senior associate AD, you're not the guy. Am I right about that?
So. I said thanks, but no thanks. Yeah, just letting them know.
Well, there are openings, I understand. Like three of them, right? Gino and Visalia, your good friend. He and Benito, who both remember so well your night in Bakersfield, and every time they bring it up, I forward the emails to you. You know, Gino was mentioning to me, they got rid of everybody in the athletic department except the one guy that Trojan fans want to see gone. So there you go. And also, the other day, when we were talking bad about USC, Benito, our good friend from Reedley, emailed in Marcus and said, you know what, this should be a regular segment every week. What's wrong with USC? So there you go. I know you'd like to chime in, but we're not going to get to that right now. Em, I want to start, because there are a lot of emails about the 49ers, and most of the time we don't get to it. On a Friday, we'll touch upon the Niners during the year, but it's not always relevant. It is right now, that's for sure. And I wanted to bring this up to you because it's the context of what I fear may happen on Sunday, okay? I've told you that I named my son, his middle name, after Rocky Marciano, the late great heavyweight champion, only undefeated heavyweight champion in history. And the reason I did is because The Rock refused to lose. I mean, that's all there is to it. He has his nose split open when he was the champion. 13th round, the doctor comes over and says, Rock, you know what? You're going to bleed to death. You got one more round. He goes out there, knocks the guy out, and wins. I bring it up, Marcus, because that chip on the shoulder, that fear of failure, I think drives Aaron Rodgers more than anything else. The heart of a champion. We've mentioned that we saw Aaron when nobody knew who he was. When he came in to play Fresno City College in 2002, which seems like forever ago when Butte came down from Oroville. And as I mentioned to you, it was a shootout that I think Fresno City won like 62-58. And after the game, Tony Kubilia came up, and I said, who is that guy? He goes, I don't know, but unless he's on my team, I don't want to see him again, right? We had no idea who he was. Jeff Tedford didn't know who he was when Jeff went to scout Garrett Cross, the tight end, to come to Cal. And he said, who is the guy throwing the ball to you? So what I'm saying is this is an Aaron Rodgers who was not recruited heavily out of high school, who really fell into an opportunity because Teddy saw something in him that brought him to Cal. And you and I know as 49er fans, he desperately wanted to be a 49er. He had all the pennants on the walls up at home. He had the young jersey. He had all this stuff going on. And you know the painful nature of draft day with Aaron Rodgers being passed over all the way to the bottom of the first round. They even played the sound bite just a few minutes ago on ESPN of Rodgers in the interview saying, you know, are you sorry the 49ers didn't draft you? And he said, not nearly as sorry as they're going to be that they didn't draft me. I bring this up because if this were a mano, a la heavyweight championship battle, there's no doubt in my mind Aaron Rodgers would not be defeated. But this is a team game, Em, so I ask you, even though he has the heart of a champion, does he have enough around him to face a team that kicked his team's rear end just a few weeks ago?
I don't think so. I do think it's going to be quite a bit closer, though, than it was. Was that week 12? Whenever it was they played earlier in the season, I don't expect the Niners to go out and win by, you know, 3-4 touchdowns. But I don't know that the Packers offensively even really have enough. The Seahawks made a very curious decision to not cover Devontae Adams, which, you know, I'm no defensive specialist, but I would have advised against that. I feel like the Niners will have a better answer for Devontae Adams and force Rodgers to maybe go to some of his other weapons who haven't been quite as productive this year. And I think on the other side of the ball, I don't know that the Packer defense has enough to quite slow down either the running game or George Kittle. And I think the Niners will figure out a way to win this thing.
What happened in week 12 was a terrible performance by Rodgers. And the 49ers, as you know, Marcus, are actually healthier now. But I want to take you back to the start of Steve Young's tenure at quarterback for the Niners, and he had a playoff game against the Redskins, and in that playoff game, he threw at least two passes that should have been intercepted by the Skins. They dropped them. Michael Carter, playing those, picked up a fumble, rumbled it in. The 49ers won, but the next week the wheels came off against Dallas in the title game. When you look at Garoppolo and what happened last week from a 49er perspective, are you worried that Garoppolo still is not ready to take the reins at this point and win the game himself rather than just not lose it?
I mean, I think that is a concern, that if the Niners do find themselves down in this game and they have to put it on Garoppolo's shoulders, that maybe there is some concern. And I think you saw some of that from Kyle Shanahan last week. I mean, they had that drive in the second half, but they just ran the ball like 7-8 times and scored a touchdown. And they really tried to sort of, I think, hide Garoppolo a little bit in the second half of that game. They didn't need him. Their defense was playing well enough. They were running the football effectively enough that it wasn't really an issue. But I think, again, that makes it incumbent upon this team, on 49ers, to go out and try to get a lead and put Garoppolo in a situation where he doesn't have to go out and win the football game. I mean, he's done it. We've seen him do it. But I don't know that it's something that I think they're comfortable with him doing regularly, especially not in such a huge situation.
You know, a lot has been made of the fact that for Garoppolo and for the 49ers, they're a young team right now. This is the infancy of what should be a really good run over the next several years. Is this the last hurrah for Rodgers and the group around him? I know it's been an ever-changing group, but is this something where you say, you know what, for Rodgers, who has been as good as anybody, this might be the window closing. And does that, again, make any difference? You know, that stuff that Madden talked about, Marcus, you know, your momentum, your desire is only applicable until you're staring out your ear hole, right? I mean, where is there an aura of desperation that can carry Rodgers through, or is that just not applicable, again, in a team sport like this?
Yeah, I mean, he may personally feel that sort of thing. I don't know, though, that this is the last go-around for this group, for this Packer team. I mean, yes, Rodgers is certainly getting older, and I think, you know, his opportunities are getting fewer and fewer, but I think some of the key pieces around him are still fairly young. Davante Adams is still fairly young in his career. Aaron Jones is early in his career, and they have a young head coach who, you know, is believed to be kind of the next answer, right? He's going to be the next offensive guy to kind of get this thing going again. So I think there are some pieces there. I can certainly see the Packers making another run in the next year or two, but you're getting to a point now where it is getting close, and you've had Aaron Rodgers for all these years, and you have one championship to show for it. I think you know, maybe not within the team per se, but I think if you talk to Rodgers and he was being perfectly honest with you, I think it would be something that's sort of weighing on his mind as he gets toward the end of his career.
All right, will it be close on Sunday, or will it be another route?
I think it's going to be close on Sunday. I think the Niners, you know, maybe get out to a lead and kind of have to hang on, but it'll be a lot closer than what we saw earlier in the season.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. I you know, everything went wrong, and I don't know. Watching that game again, I'm not sure there was immediacy that the Packers had. Maybe Rodgers, but the 49ers definitely at that point, I think, felt as though they needed to get to the whip hand for the stretch run. The last thing about this is one thing I want to ask you about in regard to the Niners where we talk about the other game. But are the 49ers, Marcus, as currently configured, definitely the best team remaining? I bring it up because I was talking the other day that at the start of the 70s, that, you know, for people of my age that were 49er fans, we suffered through a miserable 1960s. You know, the Giants kept finishing second, so you always had the hope, the Giants, well, not the New York Giants, the San Francisco Giants, you always had the hope they would somehow win the National League at some point, right? But the Cardinals or the Dodgers, but they were always good. Well, you have Mays, McCovey, and, you know, Cepeda and those guys. You should be good, right? The 49ers were just never any good. And then all of a sudden, start of the 70s, they were good. And they get to this time, the conference title games. They were favored to go all the way through, and they ended up losing. And then there was a long abyss after 72 until the surprise of 81. Right now, Em, as you view this team, are they definitely the best team, period, whether they win or not? Are they the best team on paper of the four remaining?
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, I think they are as close to the, you know, the most complete team as we've seen in that's left in the playoffs right now. I mean, I think that, you know, they don't obviously have the best quarterback, but Garoppolo, I think, is good enough. I think their running game is as good. You know, they don't have a Derrick Henry, but I think with the guys they have back there, I think they're very, very good. I think defensively, they are the most complete team in the postseason right now. I think we've seen some good things out of their wide receivers with Deebo Samuel, and, you know, we know what George Kittle can do. So, yeah, there are definitely some holes, I think, somewhere there. I think, you know, Akella Witherspoon may be in for a difficult day at times, but I think when you compare them, you know, as they would say, pound for pound with everybody left in the postseason, I think they are the best team standing.
Well, I'll tell you, Sunday, if they don't give Rodgers time, they're going to be okay. If they give him time, he'll find the way to cut him up. But, boy, it's going to be tough for him to get time against that defensive front. At least that's my hope anyway. No knock against Aaron. He's a great, great quarterback. But you know what? He got his one. He doesn't need another one, does he? You want to go with me to Wisconsin and try to sell that one? Would you like that? You want to take a quick road trip before Levi's on Sunday? All right. The other thing I want to ask you about quickly here, and I had this debate with Ronnie Lott several years ago, and I thought Ronnie and I were seeing it the same way, but he might have had a more educated opinion. It's just between you and I. And the B actually has a poll right now, and I want to thank Joe Davidson, the national writer, for bringing up the Roger Craig fumble during the piece, because otherwise I would have had to bring it up. But as for the all-time best 49er team, and I think hands down, Marcus, it's 89. That was a team that was 17-2, the only two losses, one to the Rams early in the year at Candlestick and one to the Packers later in the year that should not have been a loss. There were, Chet Brooks picked off a pass the day later. They did the old apology, right? Sorry, there shouldn't have been pass interference, that kind of stuff. But it's the team that outscored the opposition 126-26 in the playoffs and won the Super Bowl 55-10. I thought that was the best team. ESPN.com picked them as the best Super Bowl team ever in a single season. Ronnie Lott still says the 84 team was better. What say you, since you were old enough to see both of those teams?
Yeah, I think I tend to lean toward 89 as well. I mean, that team was just a juggernaut. In every phase of the game, they were just so good. I mean, the 84 team was certainly very good, but I think I'm going to go with the consensus right now and go 89.
Yeah, look, I'll tell you what. The defense was great. The offense, and I just look at that offense. You had Montana still very much in his prime. You had Roger Craig and Tom Rathman in the backfield. You had Jerry Rice and John Taylor as your wideouts, Brent Jones as your tight end, and you had at least three, if not four, Pro Bowlers, including Jesse Sapolo, on that offensive front. I don't know offensively how you can be better than that. It just seems like a long time ago, and even though 94 was terrific, Marcus, amazingly, we are 25 years removed from that. Would you, before we talk about the other game, want to make an assumption that this is going to be the year they get that sixth title? Because you and I both know if Harbaugh didn't call that timeout in February of 13 after that handy power outage in New Orleans, they would have their sixth. Is it going to be their sixth this year?
I think so. Like I've been saying, the two teams that worried me in the playoffs as a Niner fan were the Saints and the Ravens, and both of them have been sent home already. And, you know, that's not to say that, you know, Patrick Mahomes or Derrick Henry or those teams aren't formidable, but I think the Niners would have a tougher time, or an easier time, I should say, with either of those two teams than they would have with, say, trying to defend Lamar Jackson.
Yeah, I would agree, but I'm not going to count anything even Sunday at this point. They're better than the Packers, but Garoppolo's got to quit throwing it. He's got to throw it to the guys in red, not the guys that are in green and yellow, and that will help. Although he still looks great in the post-game press conference, and I guess that's all that counts, right? That's pretty amazing the other day. You know, he's got the closely cropped beard and everybody swooning, for goodness sake, and it looks like Aaron had been hiking up in the hills as he came down. I'm not so sure. I guess he went back home. It's horrible for a while, right? You'll have to up there to take a look and see what's going on, because did you see the mountain man? Bill Walton would have been proud of that look. Did you see that?
Yeah, I'm just wondering, it's like a hockey player, so he's growing a playoff beard? Is that what this is right now?
Yeah, I think so. He can do whatever he wants, for goodness sake. All right, the other side, I have brought this up to you in regard to the old Saturday afternoons when we had the Professional Bowlers Association on ABC, and you always had the scaffolding, right, where you had the final five and five played four, the winner of that played three, the winner of that played two, and then the winner would play the guy who was the top seed. And on paper, Marcus, obviously, if you were the top seed, you only had to win one match, so you were in great shape. But you also knew mandatorily whoever you played will have just have won, and they might have won two or three, meaning the hot shoe was always right there in front of you. You know why I'm asking this. Kansas City turned one around big time, but that was against inferior competition. Now you are playing the hot shoe. Are the Titans coming in a position with Henry that they can actually get this done, because they are playing the best football right now of anybody when you look at where they have gone and what they've done the last couple of weeks?
Yeah, I mean, you can't count them out at this point with the way they have played. And, you know, obviously Henry has been the headliner, but that defense has been pretty outstanding as well. I think if you were the Chiefs, you've got to figure out how to make Ryan Tannehill beat you. I mean, he hasn't had to do much in the first couple of games. They haven't asked him to. He hasn't needed to. But I think if you were the Chiefs, and maybe this helps because you have a quick strike offense. I mean, we saw the way they basically just thundered over the Texans last week. If they can go out and score quickly a couple of times, put up a couple of touchdowns, and maybe force – Tannehill to have to throw the football a little bit more, then maybe that helps them out a little bit. Although, you know, Tannehill has played very well this year. But if it's another situation where Derrick Henry is running for 150, you know, close to 200 yards, it could be another long day. And I think, you know, look, if you're the Titans, you are encouraged by the fact that you did beat the Chiefs earlier this year with Patrick Mahomes on the field. So, you know, you at least have a blueprint for how to beat this Kansas City team. And so I think for that alone, it's hard to count the Titans out this week.
I know every year is a different year, but when you historically look at the weight of expectation of a franchise, Marcus, you know the failures that the Chiefs have had at home in the playoffs. Now, most of it on Marty Schottenheimer's back, but also on Reed's as well. Does that play in at all? I mean, the guy that cost them last time is on the 49ers in D Ford for lining up offside, or they would have been in the Super Bowl last year. I mean, is there anything to that at all, that, oh, no, here we go again, we're home, we're favored, everything has fallen our way, the Ravens are done, so we've got all the control, it has not worked out for them. Does that mean anything to the team that's taking the field on Sunday, however?
I think that for the most part, I don't think those guys are really thinking about it, but I feel like it's one of those things where if something goes bad, especially early on, I think you'll feel it in the stadium. I think the fans who, you know, look, the players sort of come and go. The fans are there forever. And so I think if something were to go bad early, I think those fans who have experienced this before maybe start to tighten up a little bit. And I think that tension maybe sort of trickles through the stadium a little bit. But you're right. I mean, the franchise itself has had a lot of tough games in the postseason. Andy Reid's postseason luck has not been particularly great. So there are a lot of storylines that I think have the fans and at least, you know, the announcers and the media things to kind of chew on a little bit. But I would think that if you ask the players, they look at it and say, look, this is a one-game situation, and what happened in the past doesn't matter. Hey, look, and I remember us talking to Eric Chavez about the A's, and he, you know, him saying that, yeah, it does sort of matter, but I don't know that that's a thing that if you're the Chiefs, you can allow to sort of creep into your mind come Sunday.
Yeah, you're right about that. Also, I would think that coming, even though the Texans were not a truly great team, you know, location, 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 right? It applies to real estate and also your divisional setup, right? The Titans happen to be in the right, or the Texans happen to be in the right division to get the seed they got. But wouldn't coming back from 24-0 so resoundingly remove some of the pucker? I mean, a little bit anyway.
Yeah, you would think so. And, you know, I think even if you're the Chiefs, you look at how you got down 24-0, it was sort of out of the ordinary, right? I mean, the Texans had one drive, and then there was a blocked punt return for a touchdown, then a muffed punt that was recovered. And so a lot of that was self-inflicted by the Chiefs. Once they got that shored up again and just went on that run, I mean, then you start to wonder, well, what happens? What does this game look like if the Texans hadn't gotten out to that lead early? How badly would they have gotten rolled then? And so I think that is also something that you can use for a little bit of comfort if you're Kansas City.
I'll tell you what, if they don't make mistakes, the Chiefs are going to score too much. But if they do make mistakes and get down big, Marcus, I don't know. And I haven't checked the weather forecast specifically. I don't think it's going to be bone chilling in KC. Do you know offhand how cold it's going to be there? Because the colder it is, the less fun it is to tackle a guy. And one more time, if Derrick Henry is 247, like I said to you last week, I want that scale, okay? Because there is no way in the world that guy is 247 pounds. Am I right about this?
I mean, what, when he was a freshman in college, maybe?
I was going to say, if he's not going 260, I don't know who is. Maybe Tim McDonald when he played. So here we go. Here comes the shot. You, as you know, Tim was playing a strong safety at 260 for the 49ers. I don't know if you're aware of that. I've upped it from 255 now because he accused me of maybe being the guy that was going at 260. All kidding aside, and Tim, if you're out there, go after Marcus, not me. How tough will Derrick Henry be if they get the lead late in that game? I mean, how much fun is it to try to tackle this guy? Like I said, if you're a 180-pound corner, that's what you want, is Derrick Henry catching a swing pass and coming at you full steam. That's where you want to make a professional business decision, right?
Yeah, that's going to be pretty miserable. I don't know how cold it's going to be. I would imagine it'll be, you know, kind of chilly, but maybe not, you know, like what, last week they were worried about snow potentially. That didn't happen. So we'll see. But, you know, just not only having to tackle him in the cold, but just the pounding you take of him running the football over and over again. You know, like Marshawn Lynch said, you know, you run through somebody's face over and over and over and over again. That takes its toll. And so I think if the Titans get a lead and they can just hand it to Henry and let him be the closer, it's going to be a really frustrating day for the Chiefs defense.
Yeah, you're right, except I don't think it's going to happen like that, which means the final thing before we come back, I want to ask you about the local guys, Devontae, Tom Flores in particular, one more time. I want some explanation, like you're responsible for it. I want you to confront Dave Baker the minute you see him, all right? I want you to tell 6'9", 400-pound Dave Baker how angry you are about the Tom Flores decision. You don't need to use my name. It's fine if you just keep it to yourself. I don't want to usurp any of your credit. But the one thing that I had brought up the other day, Marcus, I know that the network, I mean, first of all, I'm sure that the folks at CBS were cringing at the prospect of not having the Chiefs in at all and ending up with the Texans and the Titans for the matchup. It's still not a big market battle, but the consensus, you think the folks at Fox would like to see a redo on the centennial season of Super Bowl I, the Packers and the Chiefs? I mean, is there anything that will excite them if the Titans get in? And are the 49ers still a team with enough cachet to be a draw? I know the Super Bowl draws regardless, but for the network itself, do they really pull now privately for the matchup of Super Bowl one more time?
I mean, I think that may be their best-case scenario. I don't know that the network would be completely unhappy with the 49ers, considering that, you know, they have been a good story, I think, all year long, and they at least bring a large market size with them and a pretty good fan base with them. You know, obviously the Titans are not quite as sexy a name to have in there, but you're right. The Super Bowl is an event unto itself, and I think that more than anything will bring the excitement. You know, plus, look, love it or hate it, we have 2 weeks to talk about this thing, and the hype will build on its own in 2 weeks. You know, between the championship games and the Super Bowl. So whoever it is, I think they will find a way to drum up enough stories to try and either keep people interested or at least, you know, not have them completely nauseated by the time we kick this thing off.
All right, as I hit the break, we'll come back with more of the emails. By the way, to our good friend Paul G., I appreciate the email, Paul. I'll try to get to it at length. If I can't today, I will certainly talk about it next week. But to me, the more pertinent question for you is, are they going to, once again, despite the protestation of the league itself, allow you back on Media Row again? Is that good? Is NFL Network and NFL.com actually going to send you one more time, or are they keeping you at home so the rest of us are safe? I'm just curious.
Yeah, no, I will be nowhere near South Beach. I guess the only South Beach I will be, South Santa Monica Beach. That's about it.
You'll be at Zuma Beach, I believe. You're waiting for the remake of that great 1978 movie. All I can tell you is Rosanna Arquette is a lot older now than she was then. That's all I can. Google it, everybody, and you'll see what I'm talking about. And I know you've still been sending her letters, and she says she's almost 60. Leave her alone, Marcus, seriously. She said that to me, too, and I said, I'm older than you. I can do whatever I want. All right, we're going to take a break. I'm going to come back with more. We will get to other emails, and I also want to talk to you about the Warriors, because they did last night exactly what I told you we need them to do, right? Play well, get to overtime, and then take gas. That's what we need between now. Rinse, repeat. That's what we need between now and draft day in June. We'll take a break, guys, on 50,000 Watt 940 ESPN. Back to 37 here. Bulldog Hour is still 4 o'clock, and some emails on Friday. We'll set it up for Nick and Nick in the Zone, 4 to 6. High school basketball tonight at 7. Speaking of basketball, tomorrow the women will start at 2 o'clock at SMC against Wyoming, and the men in Laramie at 3 o'clock, 2:15, the pre. The women on 790, the men on 940. We'll talk all about it, of course, on Monday. Visiting with our good friend Marcus Grant, as always, on a Friday, the king of fantasy at NFL Network and NFL.com. And we were talking about the conference championship games, a couple of other things related to the NFL, but also of local interest. First of all, unfortunately, you and I are going to have the Tom Flores conversation again. Now, you know, he's a great friend of ours. We visited with him on a regular basis during the early parts of Derek's career with the Raiders, and Tom is no longer on the broadcast as they moved to Vegas. He is also, Marcus, 82 years old. Now, look, I hope Tom lives to be 182, for goodness sake. But you and I both know that each and every year, somebody who is in that particular age group has to wait for entrance into the hall. We always wonder if it's going to be something that they are going to be able to enjoy. That's as diplomatic as I can say about this decision. So you tell me, why was he passed over for two guys, one of whom, by the way, Bill Cowher, who is actually, incredibly, a few months younger than I. What's going on here?
I don't know. I know that there was some frustration over sort of how these things were announced. That, I saw the video on social media of Drew Pearson sort of, you know, having his heart broken in real time, watching himself not get inducted into the Hall of Fame. You know, the cynical part of me feels like it was a made-for-TV event, in the sense that you could have Bill Cowher and Jimmy Johnson mm-hmm. be informed live on air and be able to get their reactions real time. I think those guys obviously have great contributions to the game, and congratulations to them. But it does feel as though like it was sort of made for television in that respect. And I think a lot of people were sort of surprised that Tom Flores wasn't one of the people that was inducted this year. So I don't know. I don't know if we are closer or further away. I know that you and I have had this conversation the last couple of years now, and I honestly don't have any sense of what this means going forward. You just hope that at some point in the very near future that he finally gets his opportunity.
Yeah, I agree. And without question, I'm not objective about this because of the relationship with Tom, but the bottom line is this, Marcus, and you know it very well. We see guys who are taken from us because of unexpected health issues, particularly the National Football League, because of the wear and tear on players at a much earlier age than we would expect. And when that happens, Ken Stabler is an example, right? While you don't like the fact that they weren't there to see that honor firsthand, you understand how it happened. When you're in your 80s, Marcus, I think there has to be an awareness, right? An awareness that you do not let those deserving individuals wait. It's just not right, is it?
No, I mean, it's frustrating, right? I mean, for a guy who has had as many, as a coach, a player, all the different ways he's contributed to the game, I know that in other industries they do lifetime achievement awards, and I guess that is what the Hall of Fame is in a sense. But it is sort of frustrating to kind of watch guys continue to wait, knowing that they get a year older. And I guess it's having guys get in posthumously is sort of nice, but it just feels sort of like a missed opportunity when that happens, especially when as you mentioned, when a guy who is in his 80s now has kind of waited and waited. If he were to get in, not that we're wishing for it, posthumously, it's a nice honor, but it also feels like a really missed chance when you had an opportunity to do something about it while he was still here.
Yep, and I hope that they resolve it next year. That's all I can tell you. He should have been in last year, actually, before that. I know the politics involved, and I happen to agree with you wholeheartedly, and I had emails about it, the less than coincidental nature of the two gentlemen, both deserving, who got in. In Cowher and Johnson, the fact that they are front and center with great photo ops for the league itself, to have Dave Baker, who is a friend and a good guy. It's not Dave Baker's fault. We were kidding around. Dave runs the hall. He does not make the decision about it. He's the administrator over the hall. For the voters, they have to look themselves in the mirror. But it was less than coincidental that they could do that on national TV and have both Johnson and Cowher tear up, and which is understandable, but you do wonder about the motivation in this centennial year. I think I want to ask you about very quickly in that regard, Henry Ellard. Marcus, I have said this to you over and over again, and I talked to Henry about it one time several years ago. Maybe the greatest route runner in the history of the National Football League, he and Ray Berry, I think, are the two that the greatest route runners ever. He had the misfortune of ending up with a Rams team by sheer luck of the draw that did not have a very creative offense nor some quarterbacks that could get him the ball. If he and Jerry Rice would have had roles reversed, I think Henry would have had the numbers. Has his time now come and gone? What happens with Henry Ellard?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, you hope that maybe down the road, and like a veterans committee or something gives him an opportunity. But I think currently he's kind of unfortunately being one of those names sort of lost to history. And I think what's even more unfortunate for him is that as the game has become more passing oriented and you have these wide receivers putting up just ridiculous numbers,
yes,
I think the context of what he did and when he did it sort of gets lost, because people just look at the sheer volume of guys like, you know, Randy Moss or Terrell Owens. I mean, you know, not that those guys weren't great, but I think within context, you sort of don't understand who Henry Ellard was when he played.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, when he was in his prime with the Rams, and there were some good Ram teams there, I would watch Henry turn defensive backs, good ones, upside down, inside out, and then Dieter Brock would throw the ball 20 feet over his head. You know, or Jim Everett would fall to the ground for no particular reason. So the fact that Henry had the numbers he did, beyond remarkable, but there is, you said, no context to it, unfortunately. All right, Em, look, in the last couple of minutes, I know you've got to get out of there by, or get away from me by 2:50, which is a goal for everybody, incidentally, in my family, to get away from me, all right? I think the kid took off to the Middle East to get away from me. That tells you how desperate people are to escape my clutches. But I did want to ask you, because I get a kick out of it, about what happened with the Astros, and the fact now that the conspiracy theorists have gotten to the point of saying that the reason Altuve did not want his jersey torn off of him, because he said it was because his wife never wants his chest exposed. Don't you dare. Okay. I'm sorry. I didn't mean for it to come out like that. But I guess that's true. But they're saying that he was hiding a wire now. Are you willing, Dodger man, to go that far about this conspiracy, that the reason Altuve was holding tight to the jersey was, had it been stripped away, we would have seen the fact that he was evidently a government informant for his own dugout? I mean, what are you at with this?
Yeah, I mean, look, I know that after the fact, everyone has kind of gone back and they found clips and, you know, at-bats and things that seem suspicious. It sort of feels like, you know, when you find out, spoiler alert, that Bruce Willis was dead in The Sixth Sense, and then you go back and you're like, how did I not see this before? That's sort of kind of what this feels like. I mean, as a Dodger fan, you can't unring that buzzer, right? Like, you saw what happened.
Oh, thank you very much. He's here all week, everybody. Try the broken leg of lamb.
Petition MLB to get the trophy. Look, I think there should be some punishments levied. I think maybe the Astros should vacate. But it doesn't take away the sting of Yu Darvish not being able to make it out of the first inning in two different World Series games that year.
Speaking from a 1951 Giants perspective, this is all overblown, for goodness sake. I have no doubt. I mean, you have old Black Jack McDowell now saying La Russa was doing this with the White Sox, right? So, we have talked about the fact that baseball does kind of pride itself on trying to bend the rules at all times. This is pretty blatant. I will grant you that what happened should not have happened. I'm also fully in support of having both the Astros and the Red Sox vacate titles. Your Vallejo brethren, CC Sabathia, brought up, I think, the most cogent point when they asked him if he thought that the Dodgers should be rewarded the World Series title. And he said, well, wait a second, we were cheated before the World Series. So vacating it is the only thing you can do. You can't award the title because you can't go back and unring the bell for the entirety of the playoffs. So, yeah, it wasn't just the World Series. They cheated all the way through. The Astros do need to be punished. I think they should have the title taken from them. So should the Red Sox. But as far as Altuve goes, do you believe it was that institutionalized? And if it were, wouldn't his teammates have known better than to try to pull the uniform off of him?
Yeah,
I can't believe we're having this conversation. I never thought in my life you and I would have a conversation where I would ask you, do you think his teammates should not have pulled the uniform off of Jose Altuve?
I think it was just a reminder in the – I mean, if this is what it is, it was a reminder in the moment, hey, guys, don't get carried away. I'm wired right now. It's like something out of a Scorsese film, right? Then he's going to walk into a meeting wired up or something.
If ever I thought someone would utter that, it would be a Dodger fan who would actually have the audacity. I mean, do you believe that Bambi would do that? I mean, seriously, that Babe in the Woods, that lovable tattoo-like character, that Hervé Villechaize of Major League Baseball would stoop that low. He wouldn't be part of that, would he? Willingly?
I think maybe the most frustrating, upsetting part about this is that a former Dodger, Alex Cora, seems to be the centerpiece of this whole thing, right? From both the Astros and the Red Sox side, that Alex Cora could do this to the franchise that helped make him a superstar. It's just disheartening.
Yeah, and you know what his defense is going to be? That I was a Dodger. I couldn't possibly be the brains of any organization. I believe that's where he's going to. You knew I would just do this so I could take cheap shots. Look, you guys have enough titles, right? I mean, as I let you go, because I know you got to get going, I appreciate it. You and I will visit just prior to the bye week, which is going to be very exciting next week, because you know, there's nothing. We'll be handicapping that Pro Bowl, right? Do you feel sorry at all for Astro fans? Can you, if they waited all this time to win and now it's completely sullied? Or do you not care, Dodger man?
I mean, on the one hand, I understand, you know, their heartache because they have waited so long and now all of a sudden their World Series is tainted and there's a cloud of suspicion. But on the other hand, like, they got their parade, they got to buy their T-shirts, they got to actually watch it happen. And I don't, you know, it's like with people asking me, you know, like about these games that Reggie Bush allegedly never played in, according to the NCAA. Like, we all saw what happened, and you can't necessarily take that joy away from me that I experienced in the moment. And so Astro fans will at least always have that moment of that joy.
Okay, I would like to take that Reggie Bush joy away from you, if I could. I'd also like to tell you that if a certain running back from Denver wouldn't have had extra biscuits for Thanksgiving, you would have had a second one to have the rug pulled out from under you. And finally, to make Astro fans feel better, I will tell them what you already know. Sandy Koufax was juicing throughout the 60s. People don't know that. That's... Is that not the most ridiculous statement of many that I've ever made to you? Sandy Koufax. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. He was cheating, Marcus. You just Drysdale, sure, but you're not willing to go with Koufax. Huh? And next thing you're going to tell me is that Juan was going after Roseboro with a bat. Another vicious rumor that never happened. All right. That's enough out of me. Ever, I appreciate it. Enjoy the weekend. Tell little M I said hello, and I'll talk to you next Friday, my friend. Take care.
Will do. Take care, Tom.
All right. Our good friend Marcus Grant, NFL Network, NFL.com. All your fantasy needs, you can locate him there. I will give his home phone number if you'd like it and where he lives should you choose to visit him firsthand when you're down in SoCal. All right, guys, we'll take a break, wrap up Hour 1, get ready for CG and emails in Hour 2. Take a break on 50,000 Watt 940 ESPN.
ESPN Radio Sports Center.
I'm John Ryder. Ravens head coach John Harbaugh defended quarterback Lamar Jackson's playoff failure against the Titans, saying today, quote, he's 23 years old. He's younger than Joe Burrow, so he's got a pretty good head start right now. The Manning brothers combined to 5 losses in their first 5 playoff games before they won one. The NFL Conference Championship games are on Sunday, and the Titans take on the Chiefs in the AFC title game in Kansas City. ESPN's Emmanuel Acho.
The Titans aren't sitting in their locker room scared. They're not sitting there uttering the same speech that we are. They're sitting here saying, we got to do 2 things. Let go of our egos and let go of our capes. Don't try to be a hero. Last week, the Texans, too many of their players were trying to be heroes. So if you're the Titans, don't be heroic.
Emmanuel Acho on Get Up. College football, Clemson running back Travis Etienne tweeted that he will return for his senior season. Georgia has named Todd Monken their new offensive coordinator. He was the Cleveland Browns offensive coordinator this past season. NBA Mavericks forward Kristaps Porzingis will miss his 10th straight game tonight with a sore right knee when Dallas hosts Portland. It's at 9:30 Eastern. It's on ESPN TV and the ESPN app.
Coming up on Monday, the best single day of the NFL calendar. We'll recap all the action from Championship Sunday, plus the latest from the never-ending MLB scandal and one-star receivers running with the law and who won the weekend. Gold and Wingo Monday, 6 Eastern, ESPN Radio, ESPN 2.
everybody. Welcome back, hour two of the Bulldog Hours on a Friday. Going over emails at tdad1@att.net, TDAD, the number one at att.net. Joe alongside. We'll get to CG in just a second. For this second hour, I want to remind you that our good friend Jackson Moore, a little under the weather this week. We hope to have him back next Friday as we continue on with Fresno State basketball. And we have signing day coming up. It used to be such a big deal the first Wednesday in February. It's still important, but has been without question usurped by the early signing period in December. But we'll get to that as we roll into February in just a couple of weeks, and then baseball right after that. But basketball at the forefront right now, and remind you again tomorrow, the men on 940, 215, Paul and Coach Q from Laramie, 3 o'clock the tip, an hour earlier, 2 o'clock on 790, and most importantly at SMC, the women's team, undefeated, will have the Cowgirls of Wyoming in the reciprocal schedule. Hope you go out there. We have an email about that. We're going to address it momentarily. Also remind you that after we're done, it'll be time for our good friends Nick Papagni, Nick Anderson, The Zone, from 4 to 6, and then Nick Papagni has high school basketball tonight, and then back to normal on Monday, MLK Day. Of course, a lot of NBA to talk about on Monday, but CG will be up in his normal slot at 3. I'll be there at 2 o'clock as we start the day, and throughout next week, it'll be a lot about Fresno State basketball on the Bulldog Hour, that's for sure, with Q with us on Wednesday, and Paul will start the week with us on Monday. Right now, let's bring up the aforementioned Christopher Gabriel. As always, 3 to 6, Monday through Thursday, 7 to 9 on Friday morning, and nice enough to rejoin me at 3 o'clock on Friday. Also with us around 2:35 per transition on Wednesday. CG, how you doing?
I'm doing very well, Tony. Sorry to hear that Jackson's under the weather. I was listening to you and Marcus, and I did want to address one thing, and I've mentioned it on my program as well. You know, a lot of folks, myself included, have regarding the Astros have talked about Reggie Bush and the Heisman and, you know, losing the right. Heisman. And, you know, I mentioned Louisville and they had a banner taken down, but Tony, I would submit this to you, looking at Reggie Bush and losing the Heisman because of what he did, you know, with off field and stuff versus this very different situation. What went on with Reggie Bush did not give him one iota of competitive advantage on the field. What the Astros did give them a competitive advantage. And I agree, awarding anything to any other team is ridiculous. But as I've thought about this over the last couple of days, I do think they should be made to vacate.
Yeah, I am very much in line with that. And you and I had addressed Jonathan's email, who was an inveterate Dodger fan. So it was really an objective view saying, look, I'm not saying, as he mentioned to us, that the Dodgers should be given the title. I'm just saying the Astros don't deserve to keep it, and I do think it's more painful, obviously, for the Astros than the Red Sox if they have to vacate because it's the only title the Astros have. But taken for what it was, if this did happen as advertised, and evidently it did because there aren't denials, there certainly weren't denials from the top when the owner fires the people involved. But, CG, since we started there, before we get to Randy and Tracy about local Fresno State basketball, I do want to ask you about this Altuve situation, because I don't know if this is legit or this is the conspiracy theorist taking it a step too far. Do you believe that Altuve was seriously holding on to that jersey, not out of modesty, which is what he actually said, that his wife didn't want him to be running around without his shirt off, without his shirt on? Was it that? Or was it really that he was hiding something? And I'm going to come back to the same premise. If he was, wouldn't his teammates have known better than to go after him at that point like that?
Well, if he wouldn't have run so quickly to the dugout and gone down the tunnel, I would have given him the benefit of the doubt. But given that he went right, I mean, here they just launched themselves into the series. Given that he went, what player does that? The fact that he went right down the tunnel and comes back out in the T-shirt or whatever, and this in with the adrenaline that's pushing the moment and the crowd is roaring, I am leaning that he had something on. I really am, because again, I can't emphasize it enough. I get it. I buy his explanation if he says, I want to keep the jersey. I want, you know, I want to frame this jersey when I get home. It's that special. I get all of that. But you stay on the field. You stay with your teammates. You stay in the moment. You don't rush and leave the field. Nobody else was rushing to leave the field. He did, and then he came back. That's why I think there is some credence to this, that there was potentially something on him.
Well, I'll tell you what. I hope that's not the case, because Altuve, to me, has been the poster child for everything that is right about baseball.
Right.
The fact you don't have to be the biggest guy in the world and all of that, and I would hate to think that he was that actively involved in what clearly has been aberrant behavior. But I guess if there's a way to find out, we will. I don't know if there can be any kind of video evidence of what he was doing, but maybe a conscience needs to be cleared. I don't know. I just know this, for a sport that is suffering a little bit of credibility hit in a variety of areas, this was not the best thing to have happen. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it is. And Tony, would you agree that even if we find out, and you're right, he's a fun player to watch, and he is everything that's right about baseball, or has been at least, even if we find out that he gets completely exonerated, that doesn't at all lessen the impact of what has gone on here. This sport will survive, but right now it's in tatters. It's a joke. And I think I understand why players haven't been punished. And I mean, Gonzo and I talked about it on our show. I mean, you're going to make a deal just like they do in Washington. You're going to give immunity because they're going to say, we want this guy, and this guy. We're not after you, so we're going to let you off. Tony, the players all knew. I don't know how they can conceivably move forward and try to put some luster back on what is a lot of dirt on this sport right now. I don't know how they do it without punishing the players, because if you're telling me, not you, but if Major League Baseball is telling me, okay, we're neither going to punish them nor are we going to make them vacate, then that's ridiculous. Something more needs to happen here than just what the people who have been suspended and ultimately fired.
Yeah, I agree with you. And, you know, we have emails that we haven't gotten to about the sustainability of baseball and these monster contracts. And the more you have credibility hits, you begin to wonder about the long term. I'm not talking about 5 years or 10 years from now, but, you know, generationally, is this going to be an issue with the sport that is, in all honesty, taking on water a little bit, because it is not the most exciting sport for generations that have come up after us. And, you know, we'll get to it again maybe in this hour. I do want to get to Randy and Tracy's emails, though, because they relate to Fresno State basketball. I want to start with Randy. Bob Kawada, who's a fine writer in the Bee, wrote the piece about the fact that the men's basketball team right now, as you're well aware, CG, taking a road trip to Laramie, which isn't the easiest thing in the world. You got to fly into Denver and then bus and all of that stuff. But the road trip to Laramie and the one on Wednesday, it's not a Tuesday, it's a Wednesday in Fort Collins, will be an elongated road trip, much like Hawaii has to do from the islands because they can't fly back. Randy asked, why in the world can't Fresno State find the money for charter flights for the men's and women's basketball teams? CG, I guess the simple answer is you got 21 mouths to feed, right? That's the bottom line about the athletic department as far as the number of sports. Is that the bottom line to this thing?
I think it is. I think it is. And then I think the most fans would ask, and rightfully so, well, there are schools that are at the level of Fresno State, meaning they don't have almost limitless budgets like Ohio State, Texas, Florida, and so on, that have as many or more sports, and they do take charter flights. How can they make it work? And Tony, it's a conundrum, and it's one that you have grown up around and understand better than I do. I mean, I'm in my sixth year here now, and I, quite frankly, I don't understand it beyond the obvious, which is there are 21 mouths to feed. But I do think that part of the success or failure of a program are the things that surround the program besides the obvious, and that is the players, the coaches, and the results on the court. It's everything that leads into that. And at some point, Tony, there is the chance that the things that surround a program that aren't part of the program, like this, start to create a negative, maybe psychologically and certainly tangibly in terms of the rigors that the players and coaches have to go through to get to games, and it becomes a competitive disadvantage. And I think with all the things that we hear about with a Fresno State and the challenges that they face, I think they have to put a priority on something like this. I mean, would you agree?
Yes. CG, you and I both know that if the men's and women's teams, and this would be self-defeating, so let me be clear about this premise, okay? If the men's and women's teams were playing like in the old days where the women played prelims, which should never be the case now, okay, let's make that absolutely clear, okay, they deserve their own stage. But if you had them traveling both to Wyoming at the same time rather than reciprocal, and it should be reciprocal scheduling, then, yeah, you could probably justify it more easily. Like this, you're talking about a relatively limited number of people and a major expense. That's kind of the nature of the beast as opposed to football, right?
Yeah, exactly. And you look at different conferences around the country, and it's not unusual, it's not uncommon where teams will travel together, where the men's and women's teams, will go there together. College hockey, for years, to avoid multiple trips to the same arena, as you well know, they will play a two-game series. When Minnesota and North Dakota are playing, they'll play two games up in North Dakota. And when they play later in the year, they'll play two games back in Minnesota. So they're playing four games on the year, but it cuts out the need to have an additional trip to both Minneapolis and to Grand Forks. Those are huge money savers. And the reason I bring that up is because we're only talking about 4 or 5 hours there. And yeah, I suppose you could bus if you know, except the weather there right now. But it's still charter flight situations. And you look at a school like the University of North Dakota, and the hockey may be their big thing, but even, I mean, they have, I think, 18 sports. I'm not sure, 15, 18 sports, a lot of miles to feed, but they figure out a way to have charter flights. And I've just got to believe that there's a methodology in place or out there that could be better, that would be more financially prudent or more logistically prudent, that would also be financially prudent for Fresno State.
Yeah, I agree. I also know in regard to this equal stage, you and I are in lockstep about this, not just because the women's program is playing the way they're playing right now. Christopher, you cannot in this day and age make any like sport, and this is a direct comparison, this is the one absolute direct comparison, correct? Basketball to basketball. I mean, we
absolutely
have bat and ball to bat and ball, but softball and baseball are different sports. You cannot at any point look at one without the other. I mean, isn't that the reality, and justifiably so?
There's no question. I mean, look at a place like Tennessee when the late and great Pat Summitt was really, you know, doing amazing things. It was the women's basketball program, certainly not the men's. The men's did a fine job for years. They were second in the SEC to Kentucky in titles, but they weren't remotely close to the level that the women's program was at. And yet, both programs were treated, the same. Both programs flew the same. I mean, everything was the same. UConn, same thing. Both programs there were winning national championships. Notre Dame, both the men's and women's treated the same. So, and you look at Fresno State. I mean, the women's program, I mean, they're terrific. I've seen them play up close, and I mean, they're great. And they have a legitimate shot to win the Mountain West Championship and get to the NCAA this year. In fact, they should get to the NCAA this year. So you're right. You can't look at men's and women's basketball at one without the other.
And along those lines, I do want to address the email that came in from Tracy saying, I know it won't happen, but this women's team deserves $10K in the stands. There's no doubt, Christopher, and this is one of the great frustrations for me personally, because, and I've mentioned this before, that's where I got my start as a student back in the 70s with a women's team that one more time was playing at what was then the women's gym. It's the South Gym now and has been for a long time. But the women's team had to come out there and actually very nicely excuse people off the court so they could sweep it to get ready and pull the bleachers out to play. And I see 1978 as compared to now, and it is incomprehensible the amount of growth. But we still, from a fan standpoint, have a long way to go. Is it all part of the package, or do you say that people do not pay attention to the women's program the way they should, independent about whether the men are playing well or not?
Well, first, let me realign Tracy's thinking on something. Yeah, 10,000 sounds great. Not happening. It's not happening, and Tracy needs to understand that there are only four women's teams in college basketball that have ever averaged over 10,000. Tennessee, UConn, Louisville, and there's one more that's escaping me at this moment. South Carolina. Those are the four that have averaged over 10,000. Tennessee used to average over 15,000. These days, if you are in the women's program, and Tracy can look it up, if you look at last year, South Carolina was the only team that averaged over 10,000. Their program is great. But if you look at the best women's programs around the country right now, it's not arguable who they are. Louisville, UConn, Notre Dame, Oregon, Tennessee is coming back, Purdue, Baylor. They are all in the 5 to 8,000 person range. Now, to the spirit of what Tracy's saying, I agree with Tracy that there maybe the better email would be the team deserves a lot more in the house at SMC than they're getting. And is Tracy male or female?
I do not know. That is a very good question, I don't know.
All right, so I'm going to leave the he and she out of it. Tracy is right to the extent that should there be more people at women's games? Heck yes. I've had Coach White on my program twice. Maddie UT has been on my program. The Cavender twins have been in studio. So has Jamie. And this is an exciting team, Tony. They've got players on this team. I mean, I just named three of them, but there's talent on this team. They are a legit 13-4. I can't wait to see them. Wyoming plays a little bit of a different style. This team should still beat them. I can't wait to see the real, you know, guidepost or bellwether match. It's going to be up at Boise State. They only play them once this year. Boise State, of course, is the gold standard, or has been. They won it all last year. And this team should, they're, at a minimum, when I look at schools around the country, Tony, this team should be getting about 3,000 a game. Montana gets 3,000 a game. Don't tell me, I don't mean you, but don't tell me that that's all they've got to do there. No, there's a lot more to do there, but they get 3,000. University of South Florida gets 3,000. I mean, my goodness, St. John's, which plays in a 6,000-seat gym, they get 2,800. Hampton gets 2,600. This program in an area of 1.1 million should get more. Tony, my goodness, how many times have you and I talked about attendance for women's basketball, for men's basketball, for football? I mean, the theme here is a constant one, and that is people don't show up. I don't know what the reason is. Listen, Save Mart Center is not my favorite place, but you're still going there to see Fresno State. You're going there to support your team. And women's basketball, listen, I know people in this town, regrettably, that still say, why would I want to go see a bunch of chicks in skirts? And to that, I say to those guys, you know what? Why don't you get on the court with them and see how well you do? Because they will kick your behind. I wish people showed up. So Tracy's right. There should be more people. But 10,000, no, it's not going to happen. Realistically, there's 300-plus teams playing women's college basketball, and only four have ever averaged over 10,000. That's not going to happen, Tony.
No, you're right, and I think it was a theoretical in what they deserve, and I do agree with you. The practical says no. Though I will tell you this, and it's something about the reality of the league, and I brought it up the other day, and I was talking to Andrew about it, and that is because the conference itself is not respected nationally, and one more time, we've seen it happen with the men now, where we had five in the NCAAs several years ago. We say a few years ago. It's gotten to several years ago now as the Bulldogs joined the Mountain West. When your conference does not have success in the NCAAs, it does impact you the next year. The reality for the women's program is, and this applies to Boise or Fresno State, what have you, you almost assuredly, particularly if you're the Bulldogs, you're going to have to win that conference tourney. That's all there is to it. And that's what makes it, I think, difficult for people sometimes in the regular season. They look at it and say, okay, you're winning, but in reality, you have to win in March. That's the double-edged sword we've talked about, CG, and for the men in particular. The good news is you get a redo. The bad news is winning the regular season sometimes may not be enough. In the women's side, it definitely isn't enough. That's where the conference tourney inadvertently takes away the import of the regular season conference year. That's why, as I've said to you, what I wish they would do with the men, and they could do it with the women, but the men in particular, one more time, let's expand the tournament to 96, play a full-blown group of 64 on that Tuesday, seeding the top 32. So your penalty for not being one of the top 32, and you and I both know almost assuredly that's where the national champion's going to come from anyway, you have to play early on a Tuesday, a quick turnaround, and then those 32 winners play the 32 as normal to get you to 64 on Thursday. We're right back where we used to start in the old days. In doing that, CG, you could then guarantee every conference two bids, one to the regular season champion, one to your conference tournament champion, with the regular season champion sitting that out. Then I think you would have greater fan interest, particularly with the conferences like the Mountain West, where maybe you're not getting six or seven. I wish they would make that change. I don't know why they don't.
Yeah, I'm right there with you, Tony. It's silly that they don't, and it's really, you know, I'm somebody who grew up in a P5 town, and I grew up going to a P5 school, but I've also been around plenty of mid-majors. I mean, I lived in Peoria. I still am a Bradley fan. I was recruited right. by, besides P5 schools, I was recruited by mid-major schools like Vermont and Bradley and Illinois State and some others. And it's frustrating because they play some great basketball in the Mountain West and in the Missouri Valley and in the Summit League and in the American Conference and plenty more. And unfortunately, networks like ours, like ESPN, and analysts like legendary and iconic Dick Vitale spend so much time extolling the virtues of the Dukes and Kentuckys and Arizonas that we pay zero or near zero attention to schools like Fresno State, Boise State, Bradley, Vermont, UCF, Cincinnati, and so on. And they have to almost beg and have lobbying from the conference commissioners right on down to be blessed with one more bid than the conference champion. And it bugs me, Tony, because in basketball, there is so much more parity. It's not a fluke when a UMBC beats Virginia or George Mason or VCU or Butler get to the Final Four. It's not a fluke. It's much more likely that we're going to see teams like those beat a traditional powerhouse as opposed to, say, New Mexico State pulling off an upset and beating a Clemson or an Alabama. And so why not expand? What harm is there in expanding and essentially following what you laid out or something similar? Because ultimately, we're going to get down to 64 teams. Maybe, Tony, heaven forbid, 64 more worthy teams than the 64 we have now. We know that we're getting 38 to maybe 48 or 50 very deserving teams, but there's another 10 or 12 or 14 that get in that are getting in because in front of their name it says SEC, ACC, or Big Ten, and so on.
Well, yeah, and look, that is exactly the point. And here's why I view this as a real viable possibility. Number one, you are asking limited number of teams, admittedly, in your first four to play on Tuesday and Wednesday anyway. If you eliminate the Sunday conference tournaments wrapping up, and you know a lot of the times those Sunday games are irrelevant because they've already made the decision seeding-wise. We've seen it in the big schools, right? A Duke gets upset in an ACC, still doesn't affect them if it happens to be the conference title game because they already seeded Duke because they already met about it. If you say everything has to be done by the Saturday period so that early Sunday morning, very early, all the selections are made, CG, it comes down to one fundamental truth. by seeding the top 32 into Friday to Thursday and Friday, you're actually going to have a more competitive first round of 64 on Tuesday and Wednesday, because you're not talking about the quote-unquote 32 best teams in the country. They're already seeded forward. So you're going to have 33 through 96. You tell me, when you throw that parity together, you may not have a ton of higher seeds losing on Tuesday or Wednesday. I think it would make it more intriguing. And to me, those are the most fun days when we've got wall-to-wall basketball. I love the first 2 days. Let's make it the first 4 days like that. I think it'd be even better.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, listen, I am, like you, a basketball junkie. And perhaps outside of January 1st, for the traditional bowl games, when we're looking at the Rose and the Sugar back in the day, the Orange, it wasn't on January 1st this year. But my favorite 2 days in sports are the Thursday, Friday, because those 32 games, you know that we're going to get somewhere between, you know, maybe four or five upsets, or in a good year, maybe about 10 of them. And buzzer beaters, it's the best. And Tony, I think sometimes, and I've explored this on the program, sometimes I think the reason that we don't do things like what you're suggesting and what you and I have talked about is because there are a lot of people running this that work from the concept or the premise of, well, this is how we've always done it. And the thinking, you know, for lack of a better phrase, the thinking outside the box doesn't seem to exist when it comes to the NCAA. They have to be verbally beaten down for years before they finally decide to come off Mount Pompous and say, maybe there's another way. And I'm a big – this for me, because of years in theater, where the reason we rehearse for 4 weeks is to test and measure and see what works and throw out what doesn't. Well, they can do that. They could do that with something like this. They can test and measure. They can expand. And they can say, let's see how this works, and let it run for a couple of years. And you know what? If for some reason it didn't, instead of throwing it out, they could tweak it. But they don't want to do it because they've got a lot of the old guard, or, and I don't mean this as a slant to the South, a good old boys network that is still running things and doing things in a way that is comfortable for them. It's the reason, and you know this as well as anyone, it's the reason that the last two conferences – that we're willing to get on board with the BCS championship game, we're the Big Ten and the Pac-10 at the time, because they didn't want to lose what made the Rose Bowl special. On a certain level, I understand that, but everybody was finally on board, and they wanted to hold true to what had been in place since, you know, the 1500s.
You're right. As we hit the break, there's one other basketball question I want to address about the Bulldogs specifically going forward, but we'll hit the break with this, and I brought it up before on air, but it's always applicable. The late, great Winston Churchill saying, the U.S. government always does the right thing, ... after all other options have been exhausted. Okay, so there you go. Pretty much the NC2A, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. They always do it right when they're forced to. All right, we'll take a break. Come back with more on 50,000 Watt 940 ESPN. Just about 3:38, going over emails on a Friday with our good friend Christopher Gabriel. Be with you on Monday. I'll be back at 2 o'clock. CG, of course, and Gonzo at 3. Coaches show's coming around the bend again. The team on the road, next coaches show with Hutt and Paul, will be a week from this week coming up. Again, tomorrow, the women home at 2 o'clock. Here's the best compromise. Tomorrow, bring the radio along, listen to Paul and Coach Q. They'll start at 2:15 with a 3 o'clock tip from Laramie. So you can watch the women's game, listen to the men's game, and get home in time to catch the end of it on the digital offering, or on your laptop or your phone or whatever. But please get out to SMC at 2 o'clock tomorrow and make sure you listen to the men, who will start at 3. Cowboys at home, the Cowgirls here in Fresno. Speaking of Fresno State men's basketball, going over emails related to Fresno State basketball, and Christopher, Tim had asked the question last week, and I'm going to amend this in regard to what Q brought up the other day, because he is right about this. Tim had asked, is there any way you can possibly see this Bulldog team, the men's team, stringing together 3 straight in Vegas conference tournament in March? As Q mentioned, it's probably going to have to be 4, Christopher, because to start yourself in the quarterfinals, you're going to have to be in the top five. That appears to be unlikely. Mathematically, they can do it, but they've got five losses. Utah State, who's been a bit of a disappointment because of injury, is one of a number of teams that has three losses. Above that, you've got teams with two or less. Five slot only. Can the Bulldogs get there, or will it have to be a four-game run, which we have not seen anybody do in the Mountain West yet?
Well, Tony, I don't know if you ever take a peek at Twitter, but I put a tweet out earlier this week, and because I got tired of people emailing me, Bulldogs fans, referring to this Bulldogs team with the word garbage. And I made the point in my tweet, boy, people have really engaged, and I'm glad they have, because I want to hear what folks, good or bad, have to say. But people are looking at this team, and I'm going to roll this into Tim's question and your thoughts. People need to understand this is a team that has some legit talent. When you look at this team, they have talent. But Tony, and to fans, four freshmen, two redshirt freshmen, they're not garbage. They need time. They need experience. They need to learn who are their leaders. Who are the guys that are going to take a big shot? They're learning how to play with each other. I mean, you have six guys, and most of them are contributors, along with guys like New Williams, who's been here for a while. Orlando, you know, out there, when you watch him out there, I mean, this is a terrific young player, but he needs work on just his basically his low post game. He needs work. Guys like Jared Heider, he needs to know, you know, where to find his best spot on the court. And the guy who's got some serious talent is Jordan Campbell. He showed flashes of brilliance against San Diego State. This guy is a player, but right now he's trying to do too much. So rolling all that into Tim, and is there any way that I can see them stringing three, or is it going to take four? Tony, I really believe because they've been nicked up and guys aren't completely healthy, I do think it would take four, and I don't think they're going to make this huge run. I think they can win a couple, but I think they're going to be better come that first week or second week, whatever, whichever it is, in March out in Las Vegas. I think they're going to be better, but no chance is this team going to win four. I know that we'd like to think they can. They do have talent, but Tony, there's still a couple of players away. I think this team competes for the Mountain West Championship next year because they're going to get a couple more players. I have great confidence, great faith in Justin Hudson and this whole staff to get the job done. But I think they're just a little bit away from making a big run in Vegas this year.
Yeah, I agree. And I've mentioned on air, Christopher, that they are capable in a given night if fully healthy, particularly if they're able to get not only a little bit more chemistry between guys. That's only going to happen as they're tightening the rotation. Everybody has to be healthy and eligible and ready to play. But guys like Campbell are going to get better. They're going to get more in control. I think they're going to be a nightmare for anybody to play in a given night. But asking them to be consistent when, one more time, they have not only been inconsistent game to game, they are inconsistent sometimes possession to possession, for goodness sake, yes, within a game. Asking them to put together 160 minutes of basketball like that is asking a little too much, which is what it would take over four games. But on a given night, yes. You know, the old Toby Keith, I'm not as good as I once was, but I'm as good once as I ever was. Okay, that's kind of Fresno State right now in a different way. Once, yes. More than that, might be asking too much. Well, maybe they'll surprise us. We'll see.
You know, Tony, and you know, I mean, if there was anything that I think has been the microcosm of this basketball season from Fresno State, it was the final 5:32 of the first half the other night against San Diego State. This was a team, and you watched, this was a team that could have taken control of the game, yeah, but it was a moot point because they did what they've done all year. They were up 21-19 at the 5:32 mark and then did not score another point the rest of the half. They had so many possessions to do it, but they didn't score another point. They ended up trailing at the half 26-21, and really – if for all intents and purposes, the game was over right then. And, you know, there's just basic fundamental things that they will figure out. Player after player, I mean, I lost count at how many times I watched guys launching from three and nobody, Tony, nobody was following their shots. And they ended up out-rebounding San Diego State by one, but it's not the rebounds they got. It's the rebounds that they left out there that they didn't go after, running after their shots. I mean, there were times that there were zero Bulldogs under the basket. And you know, when a guy is launching from 22, 23 feet, it's going to be a long rebound. They weren't even 6 or 7 feet from the basket. They were already going up court. And I'm watching this thinking, okay, this is not a team of Steph Curry's and Klay Thompson's out there. Fellas, you got to rebound. But anyway, you're right. There's too much inconsistency, too many long spells of both being able to score as well as being able to get stops. You know, they were down 47. They were down 47-41. Noah Blackwell brought, and I'm not picking on Noah, but this is just the point in the game that this happened. There's about 5 or 6 minutes to go. Noah Blackwell turns it over. Had they converted on that trip, it's either 47-43 or 47-44. That turnover leads to a run of 7 straight points. So we go from a potential of being down 3 or 4 to suddenly they're down 54-41. Tony, it was game over. To your point, those are the things that have happened a lot this year, and that's why I don't think this team can make a big run in Las Vegas, but I firmly believe it will be different next year.
Well, I'll tell you what, you're right on both counts, and as Hutt has brought up, and I was just talking to Q about it the other day, it's one thing, for instance, with Campbell, who was 2 of 14 his first time around against New Mexico, and look, he is a freshman after all, okay?
Yep.
And then 5 of 15, he took more shots than the next guy, which was Orlando Robinson the other night. It's not so much the number of shots, though those are too many in relation to his teammates, and I know he understands that. But it is the case where when he's attacking the rim, provided he's under control and not just trying to be spectacular, when he's attacking the rim and forcing that help to come from the weak side, that leaves the weak side rebounder wide open for the putback. That doesn't count as an assist, but it is as good as an assist because he has forced the help to come. That leaves a Bulldog uncontested on the weak side. That is enormously different than what you're talking about. Casting away from 25 early in the shot clock for no particular reason, now your rebounding is irrelevant, because that thing is going to come off long and it's bouncing on the floor somewhere. And even if you get it, you do not have instant offense. You've got to reset your O at that point. It doesn't work, and they've got to get it fine-tuned. It's just maddening when they do it right for 3 or 4 minutes, and then the wheels come off for 3 or 4. To their credit, they never give up, and they come back again, and they frustrate you a second and third time by doing it. So, you know, it's the upside and downside at the same time of a team that is a doggedly determined team. They just at times can't get out of their own way right now.
No, you're so right, and you watch them, and you see the talent, and this team does not lack intensity and focus. I mean, they're giving it their all out there, and some fans who've not seen them play will say, well, isn't that what every team does? No, it's not what every team does, but this team does. I mean, to follow up with what you just said, one more example of Orlando Robinson. Here's a young man who's had a number of double-doubles. You see the talent that he has, but right now, his main move is getting the ball at about 7 feet from the basket and backing a guy in. And the problem is he doesn't really have any semblance of great moves under there yet. He's got talent, but when he gets doubled, when the defense collapses, there's going to be a guy open, maybe two, and he's not finding that player. And he's got to, you know, he's looking at the ball, dribbling back, you know, backing a guy in, and he's decided he's going to shoot. They're going to change that. They will get his vision right, and they'll get him looking for guys that are open. And then when they start doing that, it's going to be up to the guys on the wings to make those shots. But right now, when defenses are collapsing, he's just not kicking out. And that's just kind of one more thing that has been problematic for this team.
And has been so inconsistent because of a few spurts he kicked to New Williams, who had the big 32-point night. Then he ceases to do it the next time. That's why it is
right.
Really tough right now. And I know you think it's frustrating for us. You can imagine the sleepless nights of the coaching staff, because
no doubt,
they'll see it on film and say, okay, we did it right. Now why are we doing it wrong? And then 2 minutes later, we're doing it right again. That's a good way to get yourself in and out of games and ultimately lose. It is rectifiable. The good news is it's within their control to fix it. Like I said, one more time, they're not being blown out by 20 every night. If that were the case, it's a hopeless situation. They're there. If they can solve it, themselves. The opposition, save for the occasional San Diego State roadblock, is probably surmountable. We'll see. I want to ask you quickly here, CG, because this is very relevant for the weekend. Maciel's email, I was talking about the old king of Chico, Aaron Rodgers, who's got a chip on his shoulder, the size of the state of Montana about the 49ers, and I don't blame him. I'm still hacked off about it, and it goes back to 2005 in the draft. But Maciel said it's all set up for this coming Sunday for Aaron Rodgers to exact his true revenge on his once-beloved 49ers. Aaron Rodgers idolized the team, had pennants all over the walls, Steve Young's jersey, still loves the team deep down. Does he get revenge Sunday, or does he leave Levi Stadium as a bold but unsuccessful warrior because the 49ers are just too good defensively for his team?
I'm going to preface this by saying I am removing the fact that I am a Chicago Bears fan from my analysis, because I've thought a lot about this game, and I believe that Aaron Rodgers leaves as a bold but unsuccessful warrior. I think the 49ers defensive line is just too tough. I don't know what Aaron Rodgers – I mean, Devontae Adams is a little healthier. He played last time. I think he had seven receptions. He's going to be healthier this time around. And we're not going to see the same Aaron Rodgers Green Bay Packers offense that we saw in the 37-8 beatdown of them. But I don't know what they can do differently or better that is going to – have any effect on the 49ers defense, which has only gotten better since that week 12 game. I don't believe it's going to happen. I think if this game's in Green Bay, I think Green Bay wins, but I think being in Levi Stadium, this is probably going to be the most deafening crowd this stadium has had. It's going to be something that Green Bay doesn't necessarily face all that often. When you look at their schedule, I think that's one factor, but I do believe that the offensive weapons of both teams largely negate each other. Aaron Rodgers is the best player on this field on either side of the ball, but I just don't see them coming out of here with a win. The true revenge and the once beloved 40, none of that matters. All that matters is, can Aaron Rodgers and his 52 other guys come in here and beat a 49ers team that early on, 5, 6, 7 weeks of the season, you and I were saying, you know, we want to wait. Well, we've waited long enough. This team is legit. This team is a Super Bowl team, and I think the 49ers leave Levi Stadium. They close it down for the year as regards to football, and they leave the winners of this game.
Yeah, it was just week 12 when it was 37-8, and the bottom line is, most importantly for the 49ers, three key performers, Ford on the line, Alexander with the backers, and Tart with the defensive back. They are back, not fully healthy, but they're back, and that's going to make it even more difficult. Though I will tell you, as much as we talk about Aaron Rodgers and the de facto home crowd that he'll bring along, a lot of Aaron Rodgers fans from Chico and from Cal, it's absolutely a home game for Devontae Adams. He is right down the street in Palo Alto, and you're going to have a ton of friends and family and Bulldog people there, but some of them privately are pulling for a great game for Devontae, and the 49ers to win. So there is a bit of a split allegiance. It's not going to make any difference for the Packers unless the 49ers play kick the can, which they've done in the past. If they turn the thing over, it's anybody's game. But I'm with you. I think they win it, and then I get to worry about whether they can get Super Bowl number 6 or not. CG, it's always great talking to you, my friend. Go ahead.
Hey,
30
Tony,
seconds.
Real
sure.
Quickly, we got to 4 emails this week. That is a Tony Diodato CG record.
Yeah, we only had about 50 others come in, so we're like chopping the tree. The minute we take a chunk out, 2 more grow. So there's something biblical about what's going on here. I don't think it's our conversation, however. That's my hunch. I think you and I can agree about that, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Have a great weekend, my friend. I'll talk to you next week. Take care.
All right.
All right, guys. Christopher Gabriel again with you Monday at 3 o'clock as we start a new week. Take a break. Wrap it up. Get you ready for Nick and Nick momentarily in the zone on 50,000 Watt 940 ESPN.